You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Original sin is not part of the wider Judeo-Christian tradition. For Jews and Eastern Christians, the doctrine's divorce of sin from morality was incomprehensible. It was not just the modern mind that found it difficult to imagine how Adam's sin could become everyone's, or to conceive of a God who would condemn otherwise innocent people to hell because of it. In no other religion were people understood to be born bad. In no other were they conceived with a permanently corrupted nature that faced the wrath and judgment of God. The deity of the West is unique in judging people before they commit a moral act. Those who first stood against the doctrine in the 5th century argued that a newborn baby could not be regarded as a sinner. They lost the debate. An alternative tradition, inherited from Judaism and sustained by Eastern Christianity, recognized that all human beings sinned, but saw sin as freely chosen behavior, which did not corrupt the essential goodness of created nature. This perspective was never fully extinguished in the West, but the dominant view was that human beings were born sinners, subject to the just wrath of God, not only because of what they did, but who they were. But is this doctrine anything more than the idiosyncratic teaching of a bygone age? In 1934, Carl Jung observed, "Christianity is our world. Our whole science, everything that passes through our head, has inevitably gone through this history." Jung exaggerated in claiming that the age of rational enlightenment has eradicated nothing, but he was right to be frustrated as the assumption that the influence of Christian ideas concluded where people rejected the Christian religion. Today, the influence of original sin is most obvious in the distinct disconnect of modern people, the feelings of guilt and inadequacy associated with not doing wrong, but with being wrong. This angst is as evident in the anxieties of contemporary consumers as it was among ancient believers.
The first Unitarian principle affirms the inherent dignity of us all. Unitarians don't do original sin. Our American counterparts, the Unitarian Universalists, won't have a bar of it either. Universalism originally referred to the doctrine of universal salvation, as opposed to the notion of the chosen few going to heaven. So why do an address on the doctrine of original sin? That reading will have given the game away. With Boyce's contention that feelings of guilt and inadequacy associated with being wrong, rather than doing wrong, are as obvious in modern consumers as they were in ancient believers. It's a lot easier to sell stuff to those who are dissatisfied with themselves than to those who are content. That point's a bit of a non-brainer. What I'm aiming to do is to show the influence of the doctrine was not ended by science and secularism. To be, in Pascal's words, comprehensible to ourselves, it pays to respect our own creation myths. We try very hard to understand the creation myths of Indigenous people. We know allegories are not about history in the literal sense. They represent internalized law, which helps people place themselves in the universe. But do we apply this wisdom to the story of Adam. Last year, Marianne Maddox, author of God Under Howard and Taking God to School, gave our annual Catherine Helen Spenceration, and she described this book, Born Bad, as a highly original and readable book that shows how the Christian idea that we're all somehow fundamentally warped has helped shape democratic politics, free markets, sexual anxieties, and even debates about whether dead babies go to heaven. Not many Unitarians would worry about dead babies in the underworld, or heaven for that matter, but being Unitarian doesn't make most of the book irrelevant. Democratic politics, free markets, and sexual anxieties can vex us all. My big take-home surprise from reading it was that original sin is a Western doctrine. I had assumed it was biblical. I didn't realise the Eastern Orthodox Christians, Jews and Muslims didn't start with the premise that we're all miserable sinners. Everyone is welcome and no one is told they're a sinner was a sign outside a Toronto mosque. Muslims reason it would be unjust for God to punish all humanity because of Adam's deed. Sin is not heredity and no one is born a sinner. Now turning to the Bible, there are two creation stories. In the first, in the image of God, male and female, he created them, and God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Well, so far so good. Hitch comes in the second story. Man created first, then woman, and she, after a wee conversation with a snake, defies God's instruction not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the forbidden fruit, and she shares it with her husband. God banishes them. He's as cross as hops. Well, leading Eastern theologians emphasize the first story, and Jesus is important later to reveal and restore what was obscured by sin. By contrast, Catholic theologians focused on the second story, the fall from paradise. But that's not the doctrine of original sin. The word sin isn't in either creation story. Adam's punishment for disobedience is hard labour. Eve's is labour pains and submission to her husband. Oh, thanks God. But no one is damned, and nowhere in the Old Testament is it suggested that wrongdoing of the first humans was transmitted to the next generation. St. Paul, who's to blame for a lot, according to a lot of modern theologians, suggests that the permanent punishment for Adam's sin was death, which Jesus overcame. But Paul actually never wrote that all humans inherited the sin of Adam and faced the judgment of God because of it. So where did all this stuff come from? Well, you can blame the early Christian celibates. Reinterpretation of Paul occurred in the context of extreme distrust of sex. This had a bigger context. Plato believed that the soul was utterly superior to the body. The Hebrews had no concept of an evil body, but the Greek tradition opened early Christian thinkers to the possibility that you could have a corrupt, sinful body coexisting with a redeemable soul. By the late 4th century, Christianity had become the chief religion of the crumbling Roman Empire. Clement of Alexandria encouraged the persecuted to resist. God has made everyone in his own image. Does it not seem monstrous to you that human beings who are God's handiwork should be subjected to serve a tyrant? Well, that was a potent threat to imperial order. Christian belief was imperial business, and it had to be managed. Paul's letter to the Romans was in Greek, so it was possible to tweak the translation into Latin for the Vulgate version of the Bible. So instead of death spreading after Adam because of the sin, death spread to all through Adam. Ambrose of Milan linked Christ's sinlessness with the virgin conception. So there you have it, a bit of sloppy Greek translation and a spot of pragmatic theology, and the building blocks of the doctrine of original sin were in place in the 4th century. Why? Why did it only take off in the West? That's got a lot to do with politics. The East was comparatively secure. The Western Empire was chaotic. It was necessary to assert ecclesiastical authority. To claim humans were born bad and guilty and thus subject to the just condemnation of God was helpful in wheeling people into line. Now, the sack of Rome in 410 was a horrific event. Augustine, Bishop of Hippo, was profoundly affected by it. He was a sensitive man and also a theological genius. He looked and just saw evil, and he managed to formulate the new Latin tradition. The doctrine of original sin became the official doctrine of the Catholic Church. So it was born in a period of dreadful turmoil. It went on to become a terrifically good earner, that is, sin, for the Catholic Church. Martin Luther, when he nailed 95 theses to the church door in Wittenberg, condemned the selling of indulgences and the sacrament of confession. He decreed sexual desire was part of God's creation and marriage was a divinely noble business. He transferred guilt for the fall from Eve to Adam. So what went wrong? Well, poverty was no longer a holy calling. Salvation wasn't aided by giving alms. The only aid agency in town, the Catholic Church, was expelled or undermined. Furthermore, he vigorously supported the practice of infant baptism, and he did not condemn the doctrine of original sin. Instead, he claimed all people were sinners but could become saints. This was the Lutheran twist. At the same time, saved and lost. That was the tagline. The Lutheran Church never came to terms with its founder's enjoyment of sex. Lutheran towns carried on dancing, drinking and singing, but Lutheranism didn't get much past the Germanic world. Germany, Scandinavia, that was about it. The form of Protestantism that really had legs was Calvinism, and the followers of John Calvin had no qualms about condemning humans for almost everything, but especially sex. Why was such a doomy, gloomy, you can't play cards, you can't dance, you can't do almost anything? Why was it so successful? Well, Calvin believed that doubts about their own salvation came from Satan. The Protestant work ethic emerged from the insistence that believers live out their sainthood not in monasteries, but while immersed in family, work, church, and commerce. So the downside is the denial of pleasure, and the upside is the confident pursuit of one's calling in the world. The spirit of capitalism was born. Puritan parents were denied the consolation of infant baptism, so they were very diligent, anxious child rearers and educators, determined to raise godly adults. So we've seen how the doctrine of original sin survived Protestantism and how it was embraced by the Puritans. Let's now see how it infiltrated the secular side of modernity. Now, Freud sounds like a reasonable challenger, doesn't he? He's a scientist. He's a Jew. He's no longer fashionable, of course, but his central contention was that human beings are driven by subconscious instinctual drives, especially sexuality and aggression. These exist in tension with morality and conscious thought. This has come to be seen as common sense. Freud wanted to confront Western people with a harsh truth. Most of our sentimentalists, friends of humanity, protectors of animals, have evolved from little sadists and animal tormentors, he wrote. Most people, he said, are like little children and do not like it when there is talk of inborn inclination to badness, to aggression and destructiveness and cruelty. Watered-down Freudians like Dr. Spock package psychoanalytic ideas into optimistic frameworks. Some of you may remember the best-selling baby and childcare manuals in which even penis envy is normalised. James Boyce opines that Freud's focus on the divided self, in which even the most worthy action or good deed is corrupted by innate drives beyond our willpower, is aligned with the theory and sentiment of St. Augustine. I might mention in passing, though, that St. Augustine did not focus on infantile sexuality. These ideas develop a trajectory of their own. I'm going to finish with an unlikely modern thinker, Richard Dawkins. Now, he nails the doctrine of original sin as the main and the nastiest doctrine of Christian theology, and he employs that to open people's eyes to the mental illness of religious faith. He seems to be blithely unaware of the continuity between his own understanding of human nature and the ancient teachings of Augustine. The book of which he is most proud is The Selfish Gene. The main point of that isn't that human beings are always selfish, but rather that altruistic behaviour goes against humanity's essential nature. Now, he believes his claims are based on empirical science alone. He was an expert in evolutionary biology. He doesn't claim that the changes, the rapid changes in human society, are the result of gene-driven evolution. He's smarter than that. Among animals, he acknowledged man is uniquely dominated by culture, by influences learned and carried and handed down. I'm going to make a quote from Dawkins. "A new kind of replicator has emerged on this very planet. It is still in its infancy, still drifting clumsily about in its primeval soup, but already it is achieving evolutionary change that leaves the old gene panting behind. The new soup is the soup of human culture. We need a new name for a new replicator, a noun that conveys the idea of a unit of cultural transmission or a unit of imitation." The term he chose was meme. Examples of memes include tunes, ideas, catchphrases, ways of making pots and building arches. In fact, almost everything that can be called a shared idea is a meme. But if you go down the track, where's the science? What observational evidence is there outside of Facebook that memes exist? You don't need memes to explain the transmission of culture. And if you do use them, how can the claims Dawkins makes be proved or disproved? That is, after all, why most of us reject Freud's idea. You can't argue about the contents of your subconscious. If there's no clear track for rebuttal, the argument is not scientific. So here we are. The doctrine of original sin is in no real danger of extinction in the modern world. It's remarkably democratic and flexible. It can be adapted by religious or secular people, ancient and modern, progressives or traditionalists. Adam Smith, the best-known advocate of the free market, reworks the notion, as does Rousseau, whose affirmation of childhood innocence is not what it appears to be. As Unitarians, we condemn literal manifestations of the doctrine. We are not miserable sinners and our children are not corrupt. But how well do we deal with the flow-ons from the doctrine of original sin? For example, the Protestant work ethic. That's your work-life balance. How well do we deal with worry about bringing children up properly? I mean, the Calvinists worried about them going to God, but you can see the over-anxious parenting and the micromanaging of kids that doesn't allow them to leave their gates in many communities. And the other flow-on modern thing, I think, is the feeling of being wrong, which in any of us can lead to perfectionist traits. Another point that James Boyce makes that I think is relevant to us now is, I think we must surely, just looking back at the creation story, what people took from it was that God turned his back on humanity and went up there somewhere and leaving us to make a mess of the world. What Boyce suggests is, as opposed to God turning his back on creation, we may have turned our backs on God. The current environmental crisis brings the question of salvation to the fore. We need to discard the notion of an exiled God in heaven and bring grace back to earth. You might recall last week Andrew Usher's great address in which he explored the non-literal meaning of belief. That's available on podcast. I'm going to finish with a plagiarised and remixed quote from Saint Teresa. And it's this. Andrew would like this one. God has no body on earth now but yours, no hands but yours, no feet but yours. Yours are the eyes through which to look with compassion on the world.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.